Today we are going to be looking at the end of chapter 15 of Exodus and then chapter 16 as we deal with trials on the trail as the Jews have crossed the Red Sea, sung their great song in the first half of chapter 15, and now instead of talking about the sweet by and by, they're having to live in the nasty now and now and how difficult and challenging it is. Now we might return in a week from our trip with horror stories of travel at the airport. I hate airplanes. I hate airports. I'm not too fond of TSA agents. But then, of course, I have to get a rental car and then have to drive hours on the clogged LA freeways. And that's what tomorrow looks like. Of course, for me, who knows what my yard will look like after being gone a week in the sun. But these stories pale in comparison to the trail that literally runs right past where we're meeting. Right down the hill here is where the Oregon Trail. And 350,000 people traveling that trail, heading west, and the difficult times, the rigors, the hardships, the death and disease as they walk that trail, which makes our life today look like a stroll through Disneyland. Although strolling through Disneyland is a trial, usually as well, we won't go there. Dr. James Dobson told of a trial faced by his friend on the road. The family lived in northeastern United States, and it was a slushy, ugly, cold winter. Their car was about brown with all of the salt and the muck that gets thrown up on a vehicle. And as they were driving down the street, they noticed that there was like water gushing up into the air like a geyser. A city truck had just pulled up to one side. Obviously, something had happened. And the dad smiled and looked at the kids and said, "We're going to get a free car wash." And so he drove over next to the curb and allowed the water to pour down over his car. And he, of course, he kept the engine running and the heat on as he just kind of inched through this special free car wash. And then one of his kids said, "Dad, what's that terrible smell? And why is that water brown? It wasn't a water main that was leaking. It was a sewer pipe that had frozen and was under pressure." Things did not turn out well for that family today on their drive. And I was thinking, that's the way it must have been for those Egyptian soldiers. Hey, they're called out by Pharaoh. We got to go chase down this whole bunch of runaway slaves. We'll drag them all back to Egypt, take all the wealth that they have, and we'll be back in the barracks by nightfall. They chased them into the middle of the sea, and we know what happened there. The Israelites saw this great miracle, of course, of the crossing of the sea and then the God's protecting them by destroying their enemies. And it should have given them confidence that God, who led them from Goshen down to the valley, across to the Red Sea, over the sea, and then defeated the enemy. You know, after, what is this, the fourth day or fifth day now when they're singing, it should have been a joy. They must have had confidence that God could do anything. John Calvin wrote that when the light of divine providence has once shone on a godly man, he's relieved and set free from not only anxiety and fear, but from every care. And so that's how the Jews must have felt as Moses said, "Okay, time to head on off into the wilderness." How they handle their trials on the trail give us some lessons, some teaching about how we should handle the trials that come on our way. The first trial that they face here in verse 22 of Exodus chapter 15 is the trial of thirst. They headed out in their great adventure on the trail. Verse 22, Moses made Israel, you know, he's the dad. He made them get up, made them pack up their belongings and head off on the trail. As they set out away from the Red Sea, they went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days into the wilderness and found no water. And so this massive group of people, now most of the years of wandering, they're actually in one location for months or even years at a time and then wander to a new one. It isn't like every day they broke camp and had to move, you know, a million people. That's a little bit unrealistic. But they went off into the wilderness, away from the caravan routes, away from the way where the pagans, the Egyptians, and the others lived, singing the song of the sea, singing what a great God they had. But 3 days doesn't seem long enough to forget everything, but it seems like they forgot what God had done. 3 days without much water in a, not, don't think of a desert. This isn't the Sahara with sand dunes. This is a wilderness area. This would be like the, like walking, much of this area would be like going between here and Shoshone, or between Rollins and Rock Springs. God forbid you ever have to travel those areas. Kind of desolate, worthless, and most of the water that you see there is terrible. It's full of alkali. It's poisonous. It's evil. So 3 days out there, and they didn't have enough. Now, they already had, they knew the Egyptians had plenty of water because they drowned, but here they were off now for 3 days. So it's only been a week or so since they left captivity, and with limited supply and their family and their needs and animals and livestock that they had, they came across hope because they came to a huge pond. It's actually a small lake at an area today not named Mara, but they called the region Mara. Verse 23, when they came to what they called Mara, they couldn't drink the water there because it was bitter. Hence its name, Mara. That's the Hebrew word for bitter. It was like a cruel joke. Okay, 3 days you're nursing along that water. You look and see this big lake. I mean, you got a lot of people, a lot of livestock, but here's this beautiful area, probably more than a quarter of a mile across of water. Oh, we're going to have all we need. And they get there, and there is an unpleasant disappointment. Charles Spurgeon said, if I had been there, I would have told Moses, take your rod that divided the Red Sea and dip it into that water and stir it around and let God do another miracle. Well, he wasn't there. Moses wasn't commanded by God to do that. And the people sat there looking at water and thirsty. God had given them a bitter pill to swallow. I think some years later, almost 400 years later, Naomi could tell you the same story. Remember when there was a famine in Bethlehem? And Naomi and Elimelech, her husband, and her two boys, Mahlon and Chilion, or Chilion Carney, I can't remember the names exactly of her boys, they went down and into Moab, across the Jordan, where there was irrigation, and they were able to survive. But her husband and then her two boys, who had married Moabite girls, they all died. And she was heading back to Bethlehem and told the girls, stay there with their families and find a new husband. You all know the story, right? Naomi said, call me no longer pleasant. That's what the word Naomi means. Call me no longer pleasant. Call me Mara. Because I'm a bitter old hag right now. God's dealt bitterly with me. And thankfully, her daughter's faith was greater than Naomi's, and Ruth said, I won't leave you, no matter what. I made a covenant. I'm not going to go back on my word. Bitter pills. Jane Austen uses that term for the first time in literature when she's talking not about medicine, but about another woman who was a pill. Have you ever used the phrase that way? A bitter pill, Jane Austen said. And I know what that's like when God seems to bring along some challenges of whether it's no hot water or no dry land or whatever it might be. Well, the solution is there. Of course, the solution to the people is start griping, right? It's been 3 days since God worked the miracle. What's the deal? God, are you done here? What's cooking? Grumbling. Verse 24, the people grumbled against Moses, saying, what are we going to drink? The reaction was against God, but it was against the leader. And said, you know, you've led us here. What are we going to be, another Donner party and die out here in the wilderness somewhere and eat each other? And what's the deal here, Moses? You're the leader. By the way, who was leading Israel to Marah? A pillar of cloud, right? God was. But God wasn't handy to blame, so we'll blame the preacher. We'll blame the leader. It's all Moses' fault. They wanted water. They were bitter people with bitter water. And grumbling. And you know, grumbling is a problem. When we have pain, we grumble. When things are going good, you don't grumble. Grumbling is a perception issue where we think we should do it this way. This is how it should happen. And it's not happening the way we said, so we grumble. We gripe. It's a problem of submission to authority, to God's authority. Somebody said grumbling is a sin of the tongue, and the tongue is the hardest to control of all the organs in the body. As James 3 so aptly puts it, grumbling is a communicable disease. It's contagious. One person starts grumbling, then another starts grumbling. Trust me, I've had children. I know what that's like. I've been a pastor of a large church with 9 staff members, and one of them is not happy with the decision, and before long we're having a staff meeting, and all of a sudden there are 9 people who are unhappy with the decision. That's why I love a small church, by the way. God has really blessed me in this regard. And grumbling is a result of the lack of faith. It's a symptom of a heart issue. So they grumbled, they complained, and verse 25 says, so Moses cried to Yahweh. Yahweh showed him a log. He threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. Now, how does a log make water sweet? You got a whole pond, no matter where you are, a big one, and you throw a log into it and it gets sweet. Scientists said, oh, it's no problem at all. There are chemicals in the sap of certain trees that will precipitate out the bitterness out of water if you throw this tree into the water. And I'm thinking, okay. And then they said, and by the way, it's a great blessing because all the water that's alkaline in that area has magnesium oxide and calcium. And if the people get sweet water and they drink that, what's going to happen when you drink lots of magnesium and calcium? You're going to spend a lot of time in the privy. You're going to see it's going to go through you, literally. So it's going to, if they drink that, then they'll get rid of everything they brought, all the amoebic dysentery from Egypt, will all be wiped out. Another terrible pun. Okay, you're saying, come on, preacher, move on. There's a lot of other points here to make. One person said this was God's Gatorade, that it would replace the minerals that they were losing from walking in the sun. I give up on it. God says it's a miracle. And God uses different items sometimes to do miracles. Jesus spit and made mud out of the clay and put it in the guy's eyes. Elisha had a broken axe, remember, and the head was in the river, and he threw a stick in the river, and poof, the axe head floated up and met the stick. Naaman was told, go dunk in the river 7 times. And God can do whatever he wants because it's a miracle. God overrides the laws of nature, and here's this pond that looked good, was bitter, now is sweet. And it was a teaching tool. It was a time for the Israelites to realize that They needed to focus on what God had done, what God can do, and have complete confidence in what God will do. God was still guiding them. They were living by faith, not by sight. You see, we're all trained in the scientific method. We go to school, right? And in seventh grade science class, they start saying, okay, you have this and you lay down the principles, and then it has to be observable and repeatable and find your results and test it and living by empirical evidence. And God smiles and said, what about living by faith? If I'm leading you and say, go down here, I'll take care of the water, then how about not grumbling and just saying, okay, God, I believe you. That's what God wants us to do. We observe what God's done, take it at face value, and say, I trust you. Because the God of the universe, who created the laws of nature, can superintend over them at any time. He just did that. Didn't he split the water of the Red Sea and gelatinize it on each side so that they could walk through? And they're just worried about a little bitterness in their canteen? They faced the trial of thirst. And what kind of a grade would we give them? A, B, C, D, or F? You're all looking at me like, well, we want to be kind, but F. They failed. That's it. Done. Move on. Learn the lesson. Well, good. While they're there, God says, okay, I'm going to give you another promise, and I'm going to give you another trial, the trial of disease, sickness. Verse 25 continues. There, at Marah, Bitter Lake, Yahweh made for them a statute and a rule, and he tested them, saying this, and now look what he said. If you'll diligently listen to the voice of Yahweh your God, and secondly, do what's right in his eyes, not in your eyes, and thirdly, pay attention to his commandments, and fourthly, keep all his statutes. This is a simple test. It's a if-then type situation. If you do these things, if you listen, do, heed, keep, this is a roadmap to God's blessing. I've got great blessing ahead of you, but all you have to do is this. Now, you've just seen the Red Sea split. You've just seen Marah's bitter water turn pure. We're going to head back out into the wilderness, into this rough, God-forsaken land, leaving the wilderness of Shur into the wilderness of Zen. It looks like sin. It's pronounced like Zen. Peace and love, okay? The wilderness of Zen. We're going to be walking that direction, away from traffic, away from civilization. Just listen, do, heed, keep. Obedience will determine whether you pass a test or not. You do those things and you'll get an A. Because it was yet to be demonstrated by testing whether Israel was a worshiping people who occasionally murmured, or a murmuring people who occasionally worshiped. Now, which are you? A worshiping person that every once in a while things go bad, you have a difficult time? Or is it a murmuring person who, oh yeah, Sunday morning we'll come and sing all about Jesus? God says, if, four times, then, verse 26 continues, I will put none of the diseases on you that I put on the Egyptians. For I am Yahweh Rophe. I am the God, your healer. You're not going to get the diseases that were there in Egypt. Dr. S.I. McMillan wrote a book called None of These Diseases. We came across a copy of it this week, and I was enamored reading it. 27th printing in 1967. I knew it was an older book because it was a little paperback in yellow pages, and its price was 35 cents. But a wonderful thing, because he just says, okay, God gave all these laws in the Old Testament. What good are they? And he goes on to say, Jewish women have 2% cervical cancer rate compared to the rest of the world because the males are circumcised. I go, what a coincidence. And the trichinosis and the disease of that comes from eating meat that's impure, mostly from pork. They say, oh, cleverly enough, God said, don't eat pigs. Oh, okay. He gave him rule after rule after rule. He said, when you go out to do your thing, wherever you're at, take a little shovel along and bury your excrement so that nobody else is going to walk in. It's not going to get in the water. It's not going to be a poison. It's not going to have dysentery or diphtheria or the other diseases that come from that. When you have somebody who shows that they have a rash, quarantine them. You can read this. This is all in Leviticus, Numbers, folks. It's 1, 2, 3. God keeps giving these rules. He said, if you just do what I say, you won't have these diseases that the world has. Now, it doesn't mean that you're not ever going to get sick. It doesn't mean that we aren't going to die. Because remember, he just gave this promise to people, and every one of these people that he gave the promise to, except for Joshua and Caleb, are going to die in the wilderness before they ever see the promised land. But he says, I'm giving real medical rules that'll help you. And then beyond the medical relationship, just think of the relief of stress and worry. If you just follow what I say, and I will provide for you. I'll give you the food. I'll give you the water. I'll give you the leading. I'll take care of it. And you can walk around with the singing a happy Jamaican folk song. Don't worry, be happy, right? Now, you didn't probably expect to be thinking about that in the middle of a sermon. But that's basically what he said. I'll put none of these diseases on you because God is the one who sends disease. God is the one who uses illness and sickness to judge. But they were hard-pressed to listen and do what they said. And I feel proud sometimes that I'm not like those Israelis of old, where they heard what God said and then they forgot it. They didn't live by it. Sort of like the disciples you can read in Mark chapter 6. Great story. Jesus feeds 5,000 people. Y'all heard of it? Right? And the disciples are confused, they're bewildered, they're mystified. And, you know, Jesus takes, you know, what was that? Five loaves and two fish and turns it into a 12 Alka-Seltzer supper. I mean, it's just a phenomenal blessing. And then 3 months later in Mark chapter 8, verse 1, Jesus is talking again. There's 4,000 people here, and the disciples say, what are we going to do? And I want to pull my hair out and say, what do you mean? Why didn't you listen? Why didn't you believe that God can take care of this? He just did it to more people. But we do this all the time, don't we? We sing, great is thy faithfulness, and then fret and worry that God won't be faithful. I love, it is well with my soul, until some irritant comes along. Some evil greenie driving their car in Wyoming. And we have no good to say about Colorado drivers. They're all on drugs, you know. Oh, for 1,000 tongues, and then listen to my tongue. Just whine right now and talk to you about Colorado drivers. Okay. You know, we sing these. It's easier to affirm our faith in public worship than it is to apply our faith in our daily walk. That's one of those quotations you'll see in the bulletin someday to come. It's easier to affirm our faith in public worship than to apply our faith in daily walk. God says, I'm just going to bless you. Now, get up and get moving. And verse 27 begins, then they came to Elim, where there were 12 wells and 70 palm groves. We're talking about a beautiful area. An oasis area. Matter of fact, they have a picture of one of the areas there right on the front of the bulletin, taken from the Elim area today, just to show you what we're looking at here. Wells that brought water up continually. palm groves. I think it says 70 palms, but it's not just talking about an individual tree, but it's talking about groves of trees or such. And so God said, just follow. Because God knew when to test us, and he knows when to rest us. And he says, okay, you've been walking. You're out here in Mara. You've been fussing. You've been there a few days. We're moving down to Elim, and I'm going to give you some R&R time. Idyllic location where they can camp by the water, verse 27 continues. Simply resting and refitting. They've been traveling for 10 days or so, and now they have 20 days to just sit back and say, okay, we've done this travel. Now we've got a long journey ahead of us. And remember, they were told they're going to go to Sinai and get the law of God. Then they're going to go to Canaan. And they realize this is going to take about a year. And so after 10 days, they have 20 days off. That's pretty good. I could work on that schedule. That sounds like a fireman. You know, work 10 days, get 20 days off. Well, maybe not quite the way it works like that. More like a school teacher, right? That works just a few hours a day for 7-8 months and then has a whole summer off to do nothing at all. Isn't that right, Jim?
Right.
Yeah, that's what people think. Yeah. Okay. But as the chapter closes, the Jews are settled in on their R&R, and they said, okay, we made it through the trial of thirst, but we got an F. The trial of diseases, okay, we got to listen to what God says or we're going to get plagued. We're going to get these diseases. And so they just rest, they recuperate, eat their hearts filled, all these palm groves with dates and figs and I don't know what else, coconuts and whatever else they have there. Everything they need, all the water they need. And then they face the hardship again. And we'll see whether they heed and listen and do and have none of the diseases or whether they fail test number two as well, because the third trial is the biggie, the trial of hunger. Chapter 16 begins, and we're going to select verses from chapter 16. A lot of it is God said this to Moses, he tells Aaron, Aaron tells the people, so we're kind of condensing it a little bit here, if you'll follow along with me, of the deprivation that they faced on the trail with no food. Exodus 16, they set out from Elim and came to the wilderness of Zin between Elim and Mount Sinai 1 month after the Exodus began. Okay, we know when that was, 15th. Now it's the 15th of month two. The whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them, would that we had died. I got to get my whiny voice here. Like, oh, Dad, are we there yet? No. Would that we had died by the hand of Yahweh in the land of Egypt, when we sat by meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you brought us into this wilderness to kill the whole bunch of us with hunger. They left the oasis of rest and comfort out in the wilderness of Zin, heading down to the wilderness to Sinai, then up to the wilderness of Paran and Zin. And they didn't have enough food. Now, is this true? Yeah, you know, how much had they... It's been a month now since they left Egypt. They had none of the provisions there. They had gathered up things at Elim, but now they're out in the wilderness, no food, no water. I imagine they were hungry. I don't think they thought about asking God to help them, because they immediately complained about Moses and Aaron, not to God. They didn't claim God's provision, who had rescued them from Egypt, divided the sea, provided pure water at Marah, and wells and palms and food and in Elim. And they weren't starving to death. Starvation was more anticipated than experienced. They hadn't lived through weeks of famine. They didn't see their family and their children dying. They didn't kill all their livestock for food. So they weren't quite at death's door, but it sounds like it, doesn't it? As they're complaining, they turn from singing to griping. and twisted the past. Think of it. They were slaves in Egypt. And they said, oh, yeah, but remember, we had all this food. We had all this good time. They lost sight of the future as they twisted the past. And Moses and Aaron, I'm sure, just shook their head and thought, well, this is the way slaves talk. When slaves are overworked and when slaves don't have all the food that they want and the slaves don't see what the future is all about, they're going to gripe. And remember, they've been 430 years in Egypt. 100 to 150 of those years, the last years, they'd all been slaves for generations. They were all on welfare, on the dole of whatever the government gave them. That's all the food they got. That was it. So I guess to blame the government instead of blaming God is just kind of normal for these people. Verse 4, Yahweh said to Moses, behold, I'm about to rain fire and brimstone on those gripers and kill them all. Wait a minute, that's my version. Behold, I'm about to rain bread from heaven on you. And the people will go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I might test them whether they're going to walk in obedience to my law or not. God's going to give them bread from heaven to the gripers. Can you imagine God doing something good to these whiners? That God blessing them when they deserved the judgment and they didn't have any faith and they failed test one, now they're failing test two. They didn't heed, they didn't listen, they're just whining. God says, I'm going to send them bread from heaven. In Nehemiah 9, verse 15, as they recount God's blessing to the Jews in Jerusalem, rebuilding the walls, he said, God gave them bread from heaven for their hunger. The psalmist uses that term, bread from heaven. Later in this chapter, in verse 31, the Jews are going to call this bread from heaven manna, which is the Hebrew word what? What is this? What? And I love in Psalm 78, verses 24 and 25, he rained down on them manna to eat, grain from heaven. Man ate the bread of angels. Angel food. Now, I can relate to that. I happen to like devil's food better, but I can relate to angel's food. Just letting you know, in case you have extra cake mixes on it. The blessing from heaven was based on their obedience, and they weren't obedient. But God says in verse 7, I will do this so they'll see the glory of the Lord. In verse 12, that they'll know that I am the Lord. See, God's still teaching them. God's saying, hey, they've only been free for 1 month. They've only been following me, and they're immature in their faith. I can't expect some of these Jews to grow up and have mature faith. They're babies. They're going to toddle. They're going to make mistakes. They're going to fall. They're going to wet their pants. Because they're babies. And God deals with us patiently. And by the way, aren't you just glad for that? I could stop the sermon right there and give testimony time of how God doesn't deal with us after what we've done. But he deals with us as wayward kids who just need to learn, just grow up, just mature, only listen to what he has to say. So, verse 11, skip ahead. Yahweh said to Moses, the Lord said, I've heard the grumbling of the people of Israel. Tell them at twilight you'll eat meat, and in the morning you'll be filled with bread, and you'll know that I am the Lord your God. That evening, quail came up and covered the camp, and in the morning, dew lay around the camp, and when the dew had gone up, there remained on the land a fine flake-like, and here's this real scientific word that's used in Hebrew, a fine flake-like thing. A thing. That's one of the first lessons in homiletics, when they teach you how to preach. And then I wrote a book on how to preach and taught preachers. The first thing is that you never use the word thing. Say there's three reasons, there's two principles, there's five lessons. Don't say there's three things, or there's two things, or there's five things. So let me tell you a thing or two, since I wrote the book. Yeah. He says this fine flake-like thing is going to be like frost on the ground. And when the people saw it, they said, manna? What? They didn't know what it was. And Moses said, it's the bread of heaven. It's the bread of the Lord that he's giving you to eat. So complaint should equal justice. Griping, lack of faith should equal discipline. And God says, oh no, I'm going to help them out. I'm going to teach them another lesson so that they'll trust me more. Aren't you thankful that on the trail of life, God doesn't give us what we deserve, but he continues to show his grace? Now, he's not some cosmic vending machine here to serve us. We're to serve him. And later on, after they've been mature in the faith, and they start griping, they loathe the manna because it's the same old thing every day. Beat starving. But, you know, they griped. God judged them. They started worshiping idols. They disobeyed God. God said, do this. They did that. God opened up the earth, boom, swallowed up thousands of them alive into the pit. God judged severely. But this is the beginning. He's teaching, like we do little children. So the miracle of quail. Quail migrate through this area from southern Saudi Arabia down on the other side, behind my head here on the map, you can't see. And they've come across the wilderness, up into the Nile Delta, and then they cross the Mediterranean and go up into Europe. These are, this is the migration route between Arabia and Europe. And these small bullet-headed quail fly 2 to 3 feet off the ground. And they fly as hard and as fast as they can. And by the way, if you've ever hunted quail, you know what I'm talking about. Make noise. They're just, their wings are beating like crazy. And away they go, and then they run out of steam. They land. They can't take off. They just have to land and sit there on a little bush or on the grass or in the rock or wherever they can. And the Jews are walking through this wilderness, and God says, at evening, watch what happens. I'm going to send a flock of quail, and you're going to have all the meat you want. And they did. And then he said, in the morning, you're going to have this bread of heaven. Tiny little flecks, like frost sits on the windshield of your car. That would be something that they'd understand, right? Well, they all knew what frost looked like on the ground, and then the sun comes out and it kind of melts away and that. Well, God would send a heavy dew down to cleanse the ground and the bushes, and then send down these little, and these were the size of sesame seeds. Okay? The color, the pearly white, the color of bdellium, the Numbers 11 tells us. They could be baked or boiled, ground up, made into hoe cakes. Numbers 11 7 said that. Verse 8 says they tasted like pastry cooked with oil. Not bad. But it's going to be hard. You're going to have to get out there. Jewish legend tells us, the rabbi said that the manna tasted like whatever you were thinking about. So if you were thinking about beef roast, if you were thinking of potatoes and gravy and you ate these manna little seeds, you cooked them, made them into a patty and you ate it, that's what it tasted like. I don't know. That's what the Jews tell me. They also said, by the way, that the desert floor was cleansed by the dew so that to make picking it up easier, they could just sweep them up off the floor because they're all these tiny little seeds and they could just sweep them up or brush them off the bushes and they could gather them in. Now, science, of course, as well. This is easy to explain. God did this. There's a little bug that gets on the trees in that area. It punctures the bark of the tamarisk tree, drinks a sap, and it exudes bug poop. Like honey from a bee. You know, it goes through the system, and it drops in little droplets on there, and that's what they gathered. And they've been able to find a few of these bugs over the year. And I'm thinking, oh yeah, God sent these little bugs to do all this to feed a million people every day, except on the Sabbath, because the bugs took the Sabbath off and didn't do that. You know, there's, again, science, empirical evidence, or faith. And so God said he did this. It doesn't make any sense to me, but I believe God. I believe God more than the Jews, who seem to continue to hear and forget. Keep reading with me. Where are we reading? We're in verse 16. Let's skip verse 16. God says, I've got some rules. Gather of it, each one of you, as much as you can eat. You'll take about 2.3 liters. Okay, I added that in to help you understand what an omer is. If you think of a 2-liter bottle, that's how much you could collect per person per day. And then you crush it, grind it, bake it, whatever, and make 3 meals out of it, out of that amount. Take it for each person in the tent, and the people of Israel did so. Some gathered more, some gathered less, but when they all got it home and measured it, it was all the same. There were no extra for some, and no limit, no little for others. Each of them gathered as much as they could eat. And Moses said to them, okay, here's the rule. This is what God's doing. It's a miracle, but God does this. Let no one leave any of it till morning. But they didn't listen to Moses. And why do I want to say, well, duh. They never listened to Moses. They didn't obey God. God gives them this. They gather up and say, this is really good. I'm going to get a gallon jug instead of a half gallon, a 2-liter jug. I'm going to fill it up, and tomorrow I'm going to have more. And I'm not going to have to work tomorrow. I can just use... Some people left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stunk. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning, verse 21 says, they gathered it, each as much as they could eat. When the sun grew hotter, then it melted away. They were to collect it proportionally, by family. There was no government, tribal manna council to say, well, you know, we're going to regulate the manna collection here. No rich family saying, we can hire a poor family to gather twice as much and we'll get theirs. No, everybody had to work. You can't be greedy. You can't save it till tomorrow. You're going to end up worm farming. Now, let me tell you about our worm farm. Because my wife is a worm farmer. Did you all know that? Come over to our house, and she will help you to learn all about little red wiggly worms. Not nice ones for fishing. No, no, no. But little ones that will go down in your garden and leave behind worm tea. That's what we call that black gooey liquid that comes out of the worm. And makes a wonderful garden, except if you've seen our garden, you'll know that that worm farming doesn't always help in Wyoming. But you store up extra manna, you got worms, and it stinks. Everybody in the neighborhood knows who cheated. And the blessing would come from God, unexpected, day after day after day after day. Every day you're going to have to work. God forced a work ethic on the nation. So, they did. Verse 22, on the Sabbath, on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, more than 5 quarts each. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you'll boil, and what's left over can be kept till morning. Verse 24, so they laid it aside till morning as Moses commanded. It didn't stink. There were no worms in it. Moses said, eat it today, for it's a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you'll not find it in the field. 6 days you'll gather it. The seventh, the Sabbath, there won't be any. So what did the people do? Verse 27. On the seventh day, some of them went out looking because they didn't listen. They didn't heed. They didn't do what God wanted them to do because they were just like us. And Yahweh said in verse 28 to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? I've given you the Sabbath. 6 days you'll work. On the sixth day you'll get double, so you don't have to work on the seventh day. so the people rested. Remember, this is before the law. Before, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. This is before this. This is all brand new. Remember, God had given them his name, Yahweh. He's starting to give them rules, give them laws. We're going to get to some more of them. They're called the Ten Commandments. You might have heard of them. That'll be down in September and October's messages. We'll get to chapter 20. God will provide. Don't work. Trust what God says. He proves it. And observe the Sabbath. Observe the day of rest that God spoke. We conclude chapter 16 down in verse 31. Now the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like coriander seed, white, tasted of oil, like wafers made with honey. Yahweh commanded that a container be kept throughout their generations so that they might see the bread with which he fed them in the wilderness and brought them up out of the land of Egypt. In verse 35 concludes, the people of Israel ate the manna 40 years till they came to the arable land and the regions bordering Canaan. Amazing. They gathered it. It had good taste. By the way, it wasn't the only thing they had to eat. They could mix it with other things that they found, berries and fruit and the mutton or whatever they were cooking. But God provided for them. He said, put a bowl of it aside. In 18 months down at the Mount Sinai, they're going to spend a year and a half down here getting the law. They're going to build the tabernacle. And in the Ark of the Covenant, the chest, it's a little about the size and a little smaller than the table that's right here in front of me. They open up the lid on that chest and they put in the Ten Commandment tablets that were written, the Aaron's rod, and a container of manna that was there in that chest. As just a reminder of God providing for them. God, for 40 years, provided this 6 days a week. It's amazing. People, we mentioned the feeding of the 5,000 and John's record of it. It's in all four Gospels. It's the only miracle in all four Gospels, the feeding of the 5,000. In that story, the people said to Jesus, we'll hear you every day. We want the bread. They wanted it like God had given manna to the Jews of old. Well, we'll never have to work again. We have Jesus. He'll just provide it for us. And Jesus said to them, hey, Moses didn't give you the bread. God did. And now my Father has given you the true bread from heaven. And I'm sure he just kind of went like this. Look at me. Because when you're hungry, we have Jesus. Each day, we have Jesus. Each person individually, we have Jesus. Each one of us humbly and gratefully, inwardly. We can use adjective after adjective and adverb after adverb. We have Jesus. He provided manna for 40 years. Till they got into the land, you could eat the old grain that had been harvested and planted there. God sends tests. When we got saved, God didn't pick us up and drop us onto golden streets. He dropped us in the wilderness. And we're not going to get away from this life without tests every day, without trials. And we can be grumble. We can be grumbling, we can be greedy, we can be ungrateful, or most of us can be all three. But we're going through boot camp. We're being prepared in time, right now, for service in eternity. One more time, we're prepared in time for service in eternity. That's what God's doing. We're going through boot camp. And God says, I'll take care of you. Is it going to be a feast? No, you'll get that when you get to eternity. But right now, it's MREs. It's C rations. It's just the basic stuff you need. I'll provide everything you need. Don't worry. And so from this, I think I don't need to worry about the trivial things that happen in this life. I can trust him on the little things and know that he'll supply the big things. The details mean nothing to God. It tells me I can submit to him and that the trials I go through are going to be met. Yeah, maybe with bread and water. That doesn't sound like much, but if you don't have anything and you're dying in the wilderness, bread and water sounds pretty good to me. Depend on God, and when we pray, Lord, give us this day our daily bread, thank him. And it means that rather than like our culture, we should not be self-indulgent, but deny, discipline ourselves. Denying what we can't afford and perhaps things we can afford but just aren't priority. Every time I tell somebody about our church and say that our church tries to give a great portion of our money, 50-60% and more of the money that comes in the offering to third world type missions, whether it's in third world of Chicago or the Baja or the middle of Asia, that we can give. We can be a blessing to others. We can live frugally now so that we can live a life of giving when we have the priorities right. God's going to send us tests. I don't know what your test will be today. Did I tell you about my test yesterday and the gas being shut off? Oh, yeah, I did already. Yeah, okay. My test tomorrow? Well, we'll see if our flights are there or not. But God says, I'm with you. I'm here. If you do what I say, you won't be hungry. You won't be thirsty. You won't have the diseases that the world has. Just listen, heed, keep, do. And then I have a great blessing in store for you.